This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stocks?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome, 5pm in the City of London. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London. Marcus Ashworth joining me this evening. We have much to discuss. We have a big market story that's developing. Yields are sharply lower, particularly over in the United States. The dollar is down. Technology stocks are up. In fact, equity markets more broadly are higher, with the exception of the FTSE 100, which is finished absolutely flat today at 7,013. Marcus, good evening. I have to say, in some ways, the market story is not what's happening here in the UK. It's the fact that US data is starting to roll over fairly precipitously today. We've had a big move lower in some of the housing data, unsurprisingly, given what's happening with US mortgage rates. And we've also got consumer confidence taking an absolute battering.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Guy, because it's not up so much. I mean, there's a lot of distraction with the new appointments in the UK government. I'm just looking at Cable. It's getting close to 115. That's the breakout point. 110, 115, equally parity euro. That's a far more important story. And I think with regards to, I was just looking all at all the European bond yields and thinking it's US Treasuries. As you said, is there something going on which is far more important than who gets Home Secretary or whatever? It's, are we starting to see something of a rollover in the dollar? Oh, my word.
I know, it's controversial. At 115, I'm feeling really quite rich today. Can't remember the last time we saw such numbers. It's been such doom and gloom of late. But as you say, we've got the euro also rising. The two do tend to sort of trade in tandem at the moment in so many ways. But the UK 2-year is also fairly sharply down today, 12.5 basis points. We're going to talk about the UK in just a moment. We're going to dig into that. We'll spend much more time talking about the broader market story a little bit later on in the programme. But some quite big moves taking place, as I say. Housing market really rolling over quite aggressively in the States. You do wonder whether or not the Fed's going to pay attention. Right, let's get some headlines. Charlie Pellett, over to you.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Rishi Sunak has reappointed Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer, keeping a key ally in a post who has already begun the work of trying to repair the economic damage caused by Liz Truss's administration. Britain's new leader is setting out to the top ministerial team. He wants to tackle what he called the profound economic crisis facing the UK. James Cleverly stays on as Foreign Secretary. Defence Secretary Ben Wallace was also reappointed. Dominic Raab was named Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary. Mortgage rates remain close to peaks last seen in the 2008 financial crisis. As the UK braces for its third Prime Minister in 7 weeks, the average 2-year fixed rate home loan dipped slightly to 6.54% today, a hint of stabilization after breaching 6.65% for the first time since August 2008 last week, according to Money Facts Group. Adidas will absorb a hit to earnings of up to 250 million euros to end its partnership with Yee, formerly known as Kanye West, following a rash of offensive behavior from the rapper and designer that turned a once-thriving shoe brand into a lightning rod for criticism. The German sports company said it is cutting ties with Yee with immediate effect, confirming an earlier story by Bloomberg News. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. Charlie will be back in around 30 minutes' time. He will keep us updated as to what is happening. As Charlie mentioned, Rishi Sunak formally taking over as Prime Minister today, vowing to fix the mistakes made by his predecessor, Liz Truss.
The mandate my party earned in 2019 is not the sole property of any one individual. It is a mandate that belongs to and unites all of us. And the heart of that mandate is our manifesto. I will deliver on its promise. A stronger NHS, better schools, safer streets, control of our borders, protecting our environment, supporting our armed forces, levelling up and building an economy that embraces the opportunities of Brexit, where businesses invest, innovate, and create jobs.
What do we make of that first speech? Well, let's kick it around a little bit, try and read between the lines a little bit. We're joined, of course, by Marcus, and now Bloomberg Opinion editor and columnist Therese Raphael. Therese, what did you make of what we heard new Prime Minister?
Yeah, I think it was a real departure from what we've seen in the previous two governments, right? This is Rishi Sunak, who the country knew well as Chancellor of the Exchequer and as a failed candidate to be Prime Minister. But this time, he was reintroducing himself to the country, I felt, and he wanted to set the tone of his government. It would be a government that, and we're seeing already from cabinet appointments, includes various factions of the Tory party, but the tone is very much about the priorities. And the priorities are economic stability, restoring a sense of confidence in government, competence of government, and unity within the party. And he harks back to that 2019 manifesto because the polls are showing that the public want a general election. Surprisingly, in some ways, because you'd think that, you know, they were sort of tired of political uncertainty, but latest polls do show about 62% of the public support a general election. So Sunak, you know, is essentially saying, look, that 2019 mandate wasn't just for Boris Johnson. It was for a manifesto. And we are still dedicated to delivering that manifesto, even though the circumstances have changed, even though we've had COVID, we've had, you know, Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And so things have to be done a little bit differently. So that's his pitch to the country. I thought it was a very well-delivered statement. He refrained from, you know, sort of smiling or anything that looked celebratory. It was, you know, a sober moment that said, you know, the adults are in the room now.
Well, Therese, are the adults in the room? We have some unusual choices. We're reshuffling the deck, and I'm not so sure I believe any of these polls that say that people want a general election. I'm not sure they really do when it comes down to it. But by the by, they may run into this government. Doesn't necessarily mean they want a whole process of general election for the next X months. But nonetheless, we've got some very interesting choices here. Suella Braverman back at Home Secretary, despite having a kerfuffle, I think you should say, only a few days ago. What do you make of the appointment so far?
So it's really interesting because, you know, in what we might call olden times, we had prime ministers that would often keep a really large number of cabinet appointees from their predecessor. So, you know, Churchill, Eden kept nearly all of Churchill's cabinet picks. I think Macmillan, I read, retained about three quarters of Eden's. But in recent times, we've almost seen a clearing of the deck. When Theresa May took over, she, you know, completely eviscerated David Cameron's cabinet and so on. But here, if we look at the four great offices of state, Ben Wallace still is defense secretary, cleverly in the foreign office, Suella Braverman, home secretary, back as home secretary after resigning, and of course, Jeremy Hunt. So he has kept in place those appointments. I mean, you mentioned Braverman. I think that's really significant because while ostensibly she resigned over a security breach in that she sent an email with her personal account that was a ministerial document, reportedly the real reason was a disagreement with Liz Truss over immigration policy. Now, this summer, Sunak endorsed the goal of reducing immigration. He also endorsed the policy to send refugees to Rwanda, which is quite controversial. Suella Braverman did not want to increase immigration targets in order to try to give the government a bit more headroom on GDP growth. So, you know, this is Sunak siding with that part of the party that wants very tight immigration targets, maybe with an eye on the next general election.
Marcus, don't you think he's also trying to make this party governable? Like, that is a huge challenge right now. The Conservative Party are all over the place. There are multiple factions. Isn't one of his jobs to try and actually control the Conservative Party, make it governable?
Yeah, well, I mean, Therese and I were talking about this earlier about Rees-Mogg exiting stage left. And I mean, there are It's impossible to keep all of them under control. It's a big party, 365 MPs, whatever it is these days on his track. But certainly, you know, he's never going to keep everyone happy. Some of his choices are always going to raise eyebrows because, you know, one party thinks it should be this or that, the other. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, at some point, and I think Rishi's great strength here is he has got to just drive his own way here, because if he's, you know, he's trying to have the cabinet all the talents, which to a degree he is, and obviously he's got people he respects and doesn't respect, and he's obviously making some decisions that way, and he's never going to get the balance right in everyone's eyes. But he's got to be his own man. He's got to be his own prime minister and not be a Boris Johnson, and certainly not be a Liz Truss. But, you know, he's got to not be scared of his own shadow.
Therese, do you think the Conservative Party is governable?
I think that's an open question right now. They certainly have the habit of rebellion. We've, you know, now seen them take down, you know, we're on our fifth prime minister since 2016. So that's clearly very hard to put that genie back in the bottle and restore discipline. I think another problem on the governability side is that you still have Boris Johnson, a very big beast in the party with a lot of support. Now, maybe some of that has drained away after this, you know, after he sort of bottled this leadership challenge, parachuted back in from the Caribbean, ostensibly cleared the 100 threshold for support, but then decided not to run. So some of his followers will be feeling maybe a little bit disillusioned. However, I think there are enough people that believe that Boris is capable of winning elections that will be biding their time. And I think that could be a problem for Sunak down the road. So that also mitigates against governability. Then you have the grassroots of the party, which didn't choose him the first time around, didn't get a vote this time around. And then finally, you have all of the policy divisions that we've, you know, been hinting at, whether it's on immigration, on taxation. Marcus mentions Jacob Rees-Mogg, who resigned in a handwritten letter that I, you know, challenge anyone to decipher. But, you know, we already saw him in Parliament today lambasting MPs that criticize the elimination of EU regulation as anti-Brexit and sort of in denial of the UK's departure. So I think we can count on some of the backbench being quite noisy, and it will be really, you know, it tax all Rishi's considerable talents. And I think we could, you know, say that he's a supremely talented politician to get where he is at the ripe young age of 42, but he will be tested, and he will have to drive a line. I think the one, positive in his camp is that this is a party that does not want to go to an election for as long as it can help it. The polls are just appalling right now. It will want to try to narrow them, to try to reestablish some reputation for competence, to try to calm things down and, you know, hopefully deliver on some of these promises. It's difficult in this climate with inflation, what it is, but they will want to build in some time. And I think that will be a restraining force.
Exactly. I mean, he seemed to set himself up some very high standards, which is all well and good. And I appreciate he obviously thinks of himself in such vaulted levels. But he is going to be found wanting by events at some point, very soon, probably.
Sure.
And that's not good.
Sure. I mean, I think exactly. We can count on an outbreak of unity. And it might last 15 minutes. It might last 2 weeks. But, you know, it is going to end at some point. I just wonder where this leaves the Labour Party. I was thinking, you know, for the last few days, we've heard that they're really, really afraid of Penny Mordaunt, not so much Rishi Sunak. I sort of thought maybe they were protesting too much. Maybe they really didn't want Rishi Sunak. But it will be an interesting one now that, you know, you've got, a party that will hopefully seem more united, policy that seems more reasonable. And now I think what we're going to really see is a debate about policy rather than the sort of, you know, sordid melodrama around politics and personality.
Just finally, in 30 seconds, growth. Are we still talking about growth of the UK economy, or is this other things? Are the priorities other things?
I mean, I think if we're not talking about growth, that the Conservative Party really doesn't have a hope, you know, for the next election, because there is no way to deliver relief from poverty and all of the other things it wants to do without economic growth. So they have to find a way to unleash it. But the parameters for operation are much narrower now.
Therese, always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for the analysis. Therese Raphael joining us. Up next, we'll talk more about the banking season. Reporting getting underway today. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. European bank reporting season kicked off today. UBS, the winner. HSBC, definitely the loser. Tomorrow we get Standard Chartered. Tomorrow we get Barclays. We get Deutsche Bank. There's a whole range of banks upcoming. What have we learned today? Well, earlier on, Ralph Hamers, who is the CEO of UBS, the Swiss bank, sat down with Bloomberg's Manus Krenny. Now, UBS posted a really solid quarter and the stock rose very, very sharply today. Surging rates, interest rates, that is, helping net interest income for the bank. Its cost control finally starting to deliver some real benefits as well. And though they won't talk about it, they probably benefited as well from some of the problems that Credit Suisse is having on the opposite side of Prada Platz in Zurich. As I say, Ralph Hamers is the CEO. This is his conversation with Manus Krenny.
So we see volatility in the foreign exchange markets, where we profited a lot actually this quarter. Mm-hmm. But you also see that volatility leading to further uncertainty with our investors, with our clients, right, on the wealth side. And that uncertainty is actually translated into the need for further guidance. So 90% of our clients are indicating we need more guidance. And if they want more guidance, that's why they bring their money to us. And that's why we saw the positive flow so strongly coming into our franchise this quarter. 17 billion of net new fee generating assets globally, 7 billion in Asia, 6 billion in EMEA, and 4 billion in the US.
Do you think clients are in full fear tin hat mode at the moment?
I don't think they're in full fear. These clients, they are also rational. Clearly, they're looking at things and they want guidance, but in the end, they do stay invested. They're looking for further cash opportunities and further alternative opportunities to invest in as well. So it is all about, you know, how to diversify the portfolio and how to get more exposure to cash and near cash and increase the yield there. And that's what we've seen. But they're more on the sidelines and not so much completely withdrawing from the market.
Now, look, the other alpha as you look through this number, the set of numbers and the guidance, is net interest income. It's the banking story of this year and next. Talk me through the guidance. What will you do in NIMS this year and what's going to drive it into 2023?
So you actually see quite some pickup on net interest income this quarter already. That is on the back of further improvements in the way we manage our clients' money from sweeps to deposits and other alternatives. We saw NII going up 14% between P&C and GWM. The fourth quarter, we're guiding a continuation of an increase of NII up to the 200 million. But even beyond that, given the fact that we don't only have exposure to US dollars, with our clients, but we also have large amounts of deposits from clients in euros and Swiss francs. We actually expect more upside on those currencies next year.
And on that rates, the debate is this, is whether it's peak inflation, peak rates. Where do you stand on US rates, which has been the alpha of this year? Where can we get to in dollar rates?
Well, we expect that the Fed will further hike maybe to 5.25 to really fight that inflation. Maybe at the cost of a slight recession, if at all, but that, you know, that danger is there. We think it's okay. On the euro side, we do expect further hikes to 2.25, and on the Swiss franc side, we expect further hikes to 1.25.
Can I challenge you a little bit? 5.25% is lumpy in the US. Yeah. It delivers a mild recession.
There's always this terminology. Is it a deep recession, moderate recession? Is it two quarters? Is it three quarters? It doesn't really matter. I think for the US market, we've always seen that market is so dynamic. So the rebound will also be good. The jobs, the job numbers are still good. The household numbers are still good. So So I do think that further increases in yields will not be so detrimental to the economy.
Ralph Hommers, the CEO of UBS, speaking to Manus Krani a little bit earlier on. That was the good side of the ledger today. The tougher side of the ledger today came in the form of HSBC. HSBC shares were down really sharply today. The bank's outlook, reasonably cautious. It also took higher than expected charges for that relate to possible loan losses in the third quarter. That's starting to raise a little bit of concern about HSBC's view of the economy and what ultimately is going to happen here. Ewan Stevenson, also the long-serving CFO, a little bit of a surprise that he is going to be departing. All of this kind of coming together to produce a fairly negative outlook that I think a lot of people didn't necessarily expect from HSBC. Marcus, how did you read HSBC today? And is there a kind of wider macro story that we can take away from it?
Yeah, well, it's all about Hong Kong, where they make all their profits by a country mile. I mean, it's sometimes, it's, you know, closer to 90%, but it's certainly always about three quarters of all their sort of real juicy profits come from the Hong Kong banking system, which they, you know, they basically control and all but name. And, you know, Ewan Stevenson, you know, he may not be the most exciting guy in the world, but, you know, you don't, well, it's very rare you get a CFO of a, you know, like a major bank, GCFE, going within a quarter in the sense of, and though, you know, Noel Quinn is not a Jamie Dimon. So, you know, you got the sense that the CEO is not the most highly regarded bloke in the world. I don't know if it's too harsh here, but you get my general grift. And if his CFO's gone, you're thinking, Hang on a sec. At the same time, they're very reliant on the Hong Kong business, which is, you know, the stuff that went on over the weekend with Xi being appointed for the third term and what happens next to China. It just puts you in a situation of HSBC, a bit more risk than perhaps I would need to have, lighten up on it.
Is there a read across into names like Barclays, etc. tomorrow? From what I'm hearing, you don't think so?
No, I mean, well, I'm not saying there isn't, but I just think that HSBC, you know, is a very safe, very dull bank. And when it's exposed profits-wise in a place which is not quite as safe as it would be, and then all of a sudden the CFO goes in quite a quick manner, I just, you know, I think that's probably more idiosyncratic to HSBC, I guess.
We're going to talk more about China next. We've seen, obviously, the end of the five-year conference that has taken place. There was some expectation that there would be some relief from markets after that, but Xi Jinping has really tightened his grip on the party. He's going for a third term. Today we've seen a huge move in the Chinese currency. Yesterday we saw a huge move in Chinese stocks. We'll talk about that next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. Guy Johnson and Marcus Ashworth taking you through the price action today. Real rally stateside in equities. The Nasdaq in particular is up very, very sharply today. The reason for that, we've seen some fairly disappointing data out of the US economy, both in terms of the conference board's consumer confidence survey, which was weak. We've also seen some housing data, the Case-Shiller numbers, also very weak. The US housing market rolling over very rapidly right now, similar to what we're seeing here in the UK. Rising mortgage rates are certainly beginning to have a big impact. So what that's done is driven yields lower. That's driving tech stocks up today. We're also going to be getting some earnings a little bit later on from the likes of Microsoft and Alphabet, which is going to be fascinating on that story as well. But into those numbers, the Nasdaq is up by 2.1%, the S&P up by 1.34%. But as I say, this feels like it's being driven by yields. The dollar is also sharply lower as well. We'll come back to that dollar story in just a moment. Firstly, let's get some headlines with Charlie Powell.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Indeed, another day of fast-moving political developments in the UK. Rishi Sunak has reappointed Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer, keeping a key ally in post who already begun the work of trying to repair the economic damage caused by Liz Truss's administration. Britain's new leader is setting out the top ministerial team. He wants to tackle what he calls the profound economic crisis facing the UK. James Cleverly stays on as Foreign Secretary. Secretary. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace also reappointed. Grant Shapps is Business Secretary. And a controversial move, Suella Braverman is back as Home Secretary, days after Truss fired her over a national security breach. Europe suddenly has more gas than it can use, starved of the Russian imports on which it long relied. Europe has rushed to import liquefied natural gas from around the world to fill up storage. Now a combination of unusually warm weather and successful bidding for cargoes means facilities are almost full before Europeans have even turned the thermostats up. Gas prices have also fallen back sharply and are less than a third of their summer peak. The use of prepayment energy meters is on the rise in Britain, causing concern that the poorest households may not be able to heat their homes this winter. The number of pay-as-you-go installations rose by 60,000 in the 6 months through March, after previously dropping for nine quarters in a row. That's according to comparison site uswitch.com. That means more consumers will rely on topping up power and gas accounts themselves instead of paying via direct debit. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. Let's talk about that strong dollar that we're seeing, sorry, that weak dollar that we're seeing this afternoon. A little earlier on today, we saw the Chinese currency getting up to around 7.3 against the US dollar, i.e. was weakening. It's come back quite considerably since then. But we are seeing a huge story around Chinese financial markets at the moment, continuing to develop at pace. The Chinese yuan is certainly part of that. As I say, the Chinese currency trading through 7.3 a little bit earlier on. Now, that's the weakest since 2007. Now, yesterday, we also saw a huge move with Chinese tech stocks coming under significant pressure. This all comes as we see the end of the five-year party conference that has been taking place in Beijing. And the Chinese authorities seem to be taking a much more political line rather than an economic line on some of these assets. We're joined now by Bloomberg Opinion columnist and editor Matthew Brooker. Matthew, how significant are these moves? And do the Chinese authorities really care about what is happening to their currency right now and what is happening to their tech sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the moves are hugely significant. The Hang Seng Index was down something like 6% yesterday. That's, you know, the index that's largely dominated by Chinese companies, but is freely open to foreign investors. And that's now at its pre-1997 handover level, which is fairly incredible. And you know, it's very clear that these are a direct result of what happened at the Party Congress in Beijing. I think there was a lot of wishful thinking going on before the Congress that once Xi Jinping had consolidated power, that there would be a return to some of the economic pragmatism that's been so good for China in the past. And when people saw the lineup of the next Politburo Standing Committee, they realized that this really isn't going to happen.
So, Matt, I don't know much about markets, but when I see a 6.5% drop one day and then no bounce the next, I'm a little bit more worried than I would be otherwise. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, the collapse has been going on for quite a while. You know, the Hang Seng Index was very depressed even back in kind of March, when the real I suppose the biggest factor weighing on it was the COVID policies and lockdowns in China and places like Shanghai, which had come on top of all these other interventions in markets that have been kind of damaging the regulation of the tech sector, the restrictions that they put on things like online education companies and on big internet platform companies like Tencent and Alibaba, and it's never really come back from there. And you know, this, it's just been one blow after another, and it really does come back to the politics. I mean, on fundamental measures, Chinese markets look very oversold. I mean, they look very, very cheap. But I think it's just that people just don't see, they don't see how things are going to change. I mean, if you've got an administration that doesn't really seem to care about markets at all, doesn't particularly seem to care about economic growth either. It's all about the political program. Then when's the, you know, what's the reason, what's the catalyst for a renewed rally?
Presumably a lot of this centres around COVID zero, as you're saying. Any indication at this point that COVID zero might be eased up a little bit, in as much as we've got through the Politburo meeting, we've got through the party conference meeting, there was some expectation that that might happen, but it seems to be exactly the opposite at the moment.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there were hopes. I mean, I think people were kind of grasping at straws in the lead up to the Congress. There were hopes that relatively more liberal figures like Hu Jintao or Wang Yang might be on the Politburo Standing Committee. That didn't happen. Instead, you've got a lineup of people that aren't really associated with liberal market policies or, you know, people that particularly have experience in those areas. They're really people that have been tied very closely to Xi Jinping and share his very kind of statist, Marxist view of how China should work.
Matt, I mean, I want some good news here, please, because I said, you know, you see a stock market which goes straight down and doesn't bounce the next day, which is never a good sign normally. Though the only thing I can say is they did delay their GDP numbers and they actually ended up being better than expected, but they maybe don't necessarily believe too much in those.
Yep.
Yeah, the lookout doesn't look great as far as the lineup is concerned. Is there anything positive?
Is there anything positive?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm scratching my head now. I'm trying to think. I mean, it's cheap. I suppose that's one thing you could certainly say. The guy that appears to be in line to be premier now, Li Qiang, does have some, you know, he has ruled at, like, you know, Shanghai, which is obviously, you know, one of the most important commercial centres in China, if not the most. And
Matthew,
set up a new tech.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. Davos in the desert is underway. It's an economic gathering in Saudi Arabia. There we saw today the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon on stage, talking about their outlook for the global economy. Take a listen to what they had to say.
Consumers, businesses, still spending, still lots of money, a lot of fiscal stimulus. But there's a lot of stuff on the horizon, which is bad, and could, doesn't necessarily, but could put the United States in a recession. That's not the most important thing for what we think about. We'll manage right through that. I would worry much more about the geopolitics of the world today.
You worried about what side of the geopolitics particularly?
I think the most important thing is the geopolitics, what's going on in Russia, Ukraine, America, China, you know, the relationships of the Western world, and that would have me far more concerned than whether there's a mild.
You know, we operate in a world where we make policy decisions or we execute under certain policy initiatives, and they ultimately have long-term impacts. You don't see the impacts of those things sometimes for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. For example, now we're living in an environment where, at least from a monetary policy perspective, the decisions we've made over the last 40 years, we're now in the process of unwinding, you know, a multi-decade period, and there are consequences to that. And so I think it's just very important as you think ahead, you think about the right policy actions that you can take. This comes, you know, largely from government. It's got to be influenced by the private sector, but the right policy actions that you can take so that when you look back 5, 10, 15 years from now, you know, we've made progress against some of these issues.
That, of course, David Solomon and Jamie Dimon speaking there. They're quite cautious on the global economy, Marcus, but they're also fairly cautious on the geopolitical story. And it does seem as if it's maybe the latter that is having the biggest impact right now. I appreciate that the Fed is tightening and other central banks are tightening around the world as well. But we've just had a conversation about what is happening in China. We've talked about the UK political story as well at the moment. We've obviously got significant issues running through Europe too, Meloni in Italy. Do you think the market has got a handle on what is happening in the geopolitical landscape at the moment? Because it seems incredibly hard to price risk.
No is the honest answer. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, you can see in the volatility across all markets. And, you know, the reason why the dollar has been doing so well for so long, and in essence, is that if in doubt, just the stick dollar side. So just occasionally when the dollar weakens off a bit, you know, yep. people think maybe it's cheap to go back into European waters or Asian waters or wherever it may be, but then it doesn't take much to get them running straight back again. So, you know, I wouldn't get too excited about the dollar turning just yet. Nonetheless, you know, there are signs, you know, as often you see in big economies, some strength, some weakness, but and the US is kind of a little bit more mixed than just unidirectional. But as far as their view on Europe is concerned, and I can see why, it's they see all the bad stuff. You know, they see war, they see energy prices and lack of supply. So, I mean, you know, you can see why people wouldn't be compelled.
So what is this is what I'm trying to get my head around at the moment, is what does that mean for the next 6 months? Is Europe, the recession looks increasingly inevitable, and it looks like that it's going to be a fairly challenging recession as well. Yet at the same time, ECB this Thursday, likely to be hiking into that. 75 basis points is the expectation. Like this sort of, we seem to be on a sort of political central bank collision course right now.
I couldn't agree more, and it's despairing for me. I just don't know what the ECB thinks it's playing at. I worry a lot about the Bank of England, but they do seem to have some reason to it, whereas I think the ECB is just now being taken over by a hawkish minority who've got control of
Do you think the politicians push back? Like, I heard it from Maloney a little bit earlier on in Italy. The ECB shouldn't be tightening too quickly. Do you think...
Yeah, I think she was very fair to say it. Good for her. And I think and sometimes it needs someone to shout out and say, you know, don't get anything out of Scholz. Scholz just won't say a boot of goose. He's completely captivated his coalition. He finally has to make a decision, you know, after weeks and weeks of prevaricating. Macron, well, he has his own agenda doing whatever it may be. Sometimes good, sometimes not quite so good. Maloney's come straight in there. You know, she's democratically elected.
It's tech next. Marcus's favourite subject. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. So this evening, we kick into high gear when it comes to tech earnings. It's a theme throughout the week. Over here in Europe, we're going to be focusing on the banks. Over in the States, they're definitely going to be focusing on the big tech earnings story. Tonight, we kick off with a couple of majors. We've got Alphabet, of course, Google, and Microsoft. Tomorrow we get Meta. We're going to be working our way through this story throughout the week. What are we going to learn here, both in terms of how these companies are performing and what signal they're sending as well? The big names we're going to see over the next few days are the bulk of the tech names on the Nasdaq. Around 40% of the Nasdaq big is going to be reporting over the next couple of days. Ed Ludlow is back in San Francisco safely from his trip to New York, and he joins us now on the line. Ed, we get Microsoft tonight, we get Alphabet tonight. What are we going to learn?
We're going to learn how much doom and gloom and pain and how... No, I'm just kidding with you. Across those five names that I affectionately call the Fab Five, so Microsoft, Alphabet, the parent company of Google, Meta, Apple and Amazon, the street sees EPS dropping 22% from a year ago. And that's significant because it's the biggest drop in EPS for about 3 years. So it is tough out there. And these are names that traditionally have had very high double-digit top and bottom line growth. And as you look across the five, we take Microsoft as an example. This is going to be the first quarter for 21 quarters where we're expecting single-digit top line growth. So they're managing a challenging environment. I think what the street's really looking for is the forward forecast. When do things improve and how does 2023 look across the different range of businesses they have?
Is anything particularly look out for? Because, I mean, I guess we think Google and presumably Microsoft are sort of bankers more. Apple is the, well, again, it's a cash cow, and it seems to be diverting into other revenues rather than just flogging iPhones. But is there anything particularly that you'd want to sort of...
Yeah, the street certainly zeroed in on free cash flow for Alphabet in particular. I think what's really interesting about an Alphabet and a Microsoft is they're areas of technology sector that are traditionally less sexy, for want of a better expression. But those less sexy areas, enterprise software, when you think about Microsoft Cloud, when you think about both Microsoft and Alphabet, those usually fare better in recessions, right? There is evidence that actually enterprises continue to spend, that they make investment decisions during hard times so that they come out the other side during better times. But it's a precarious situation and the margins are fine, literally and figuratively. Guy and I were talking about this on TV earlier. You know, Alphabet, the parent company of Google, is forecast to have 12% top line growth. We're going to be seeing how their ad-based businesses work, but also their cloud business, which is not yet profitable. But what happens if they miss estimates and they give a gloomy outlook for the rest of the year? You could see the market easily becoming spooked because of how strong this name's been in recent quarters and how we expect them to fare in a recessionary environment.
What about the hardware side of things? As I've listened to chip CEOs talking from the chip sector, like they've been, and Intel was a classic case here, they've been basically saying that PC demand has hit a brick wall and is coming off very, very sharply. Now, there's a number of different reasons for it. Clearly, we all bought a lot of PCs during lockdown, but nevertheless, there are other factors here as well. As I look at Microsoft, Microsoft relies... It's not completely in the way that it used to, but it's still reasonably reliant on that PC market. So yes. What signals can we take from chips that are going to kind of feed into the rest of the space?
Yeah, so chips are kind of like a crystal ball for what's to come for the end market. When I say end market, I mean the market those chips are going to go into. What the chip sector is signaling to us is that there's been a dramatic slowdown in consumer electronics purchasing. We know that because often the makers of laptops and PCs will order in advance the chips they think they're going to need based on forward-looking demand. So if they stop placing orders for chips, that's a pretty bad sign. I think what's really interesting about the hardware space is also the impact of the stronger dollar. We came into this earnings this quarter thinking stronger dollar is going to really hit the software names because you know their revenues all around the world. Well, Tesla recorded $250 million hit to profit because of the stronger dollar selling cars. This is the double-edged sword of being a company that has a global footprint and draws in revenues from outside of the US. You're going to be exposed to a stronger dollar. So that should be a factor as well.
The WhatsApp outage earlier, is that of relevance? And more importantly, is there other things we should be watching out for in the sense of other?
So WhatsApp is owned by Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, and the WhatsApp outage was a pain for a lot of people around the world, but it was resolved relatively quickly. If anything, it puts a spotlight back on Meta's need to focus on its core businesses and how to get the most out of them. I think we're seeing full year revenue growth of less than 1% for Meta this year. You know, it's a company that's lost 60% of its market value. And a big complaint of investors is that there was too much emphasis on a transition to the metaverse, too much spent to achieve that long-term goal to the detriment of its core ad business. And also all of these other promises that never materialized. There was a plan to make more money from WhatsApp, and it's not really transpired that way. So I'm sure investors will have questions for Zuckerberg about that.
Just finally, Ed, Chinese tech is taking an absolute battering. Not just this week, it has been for a while. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for US tech?
Yeah, look, the Chinese technology sector is the clear laggard against, on an equity market basis, at least, against US and European technology. What investors are trying to work out right now is the fate of certain companies balancing Xi Jinping's ideological priorities against what this Chinese government and administration will do to support growth, particularly in private enterprise. A lot of these policies, COVID, zero COVID, COVID zero, and the ability to get the private sector up and running again seem incongruous, right? You can't have COVID zero and then also push for private enterprise to recover. So I think there's a lot of nervousness about growth among Chinese tech, particularly in the Chinese tech that's focused on the consumer.
Does it mean that money doesn't go and get invested in Chinese tech and therefore gets invested in US tech?
There's certainly evidence. I mean, we've been really defensive heading into this earnings season. The Nasdaq 100 is building a little bit of momentum. But the data tell us foreign investors pulling money from Chinese equities, particularly tech. Where are they putting it? It looks like US tech as a defensive entrenched position.
Right. Ed, great to see you back in San Francisco. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow on what is happening ahead of tech earnings, which kick off very, very shortly. That wraps things up from Marcus and from me. This was The Cable. This is Bloomberg.